and welcome to the Kotsk Podcast. I'm Jordan Wozniak.
And I am Gavin Michael.
This is Episode 7, Was Rashi a Mystic? Good afternoon, Gavin. How are you today?
Hi, Jordan. Very well, and you?
I'm doing very well. We've got a heat wave going on here, and I know it's kind of early spring for you, and it's late summer for us, so we can send you some of our heat.
Right, and we can send you some of our cold, because we've got a cold wave going on here.
Right, but a cold wave for you is probably about like 18
or 19
degrees.
It's like a heat wave for you, yes.
Exactly, something like that.
We'll meet in the middle.
Today, exactly. We'll generate a little bit more heat for you today by by talking about whether Rashi was a mystic or not.
But we may leave our listeners stone cold.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. There we go. Should we continue on with this line of joking? Maybe not. This is an important subject, though, right? Because Rashi was. I remember once taking a class, and the rabbi teaching this class said, you know, Rashi is important for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons being that his commentaries were so comprehensive. He wrote commentaries on Tanakh. He wrote commentaries on the Talmud. His writing is so copious and so foundational to Jewish education, to Jewish scholarship, also because of its age. He wasn't the first Rishon, but as we spoke about in one of our earlier episodes, he kind of comes as the representative of the first generation after the Gaonim. So he's the beginning of, our significant record of Ashkenazi commentary, and, historically very important. And Jewish mysticism is also historically very important, and so it's worth considering how Rashi and Jewish mysticism intersect, if they do.
Yeah, that's our question for today. How do they, and do they intersect?
Right, and we should clarify that when we're talking about Jewish mysticism here, we're not talking about like Lurianic Kabbalah per se, right? We're talking about something older in the Jewish mystical tradition.
Right. So I think that we need to clarify at the very, very outset that when we ask our question, was Rashi a mystic? We're not referring to the kind of mysticism that we would be used today in post-Zoharic, in the post-Zoharic world, because the Zohar was only published. Let's leave aside the question as to when it was written and to who wrote it, but the Zohar was published around about 1290, and Rashi dies in 1105, which means that there are approximately 200 years, two centuries almost, between Rashi's death and the publication of the Zohar. So certainly we're not talking about a Zoharic Kabbalah, a Kabbalah of Sefirot, which is the Kabbalah that we found in the Zohar. We're talking about a pre-Zoharic Kabbalah, which is known as the Merkava and Hechalot literature. Merkava means the chariot, Hechalot means the palaces. It's a very old form of mysticism. There's a lot of debate as to when it was actually written. According to some theories, it was written in the Gaonic period and then sort of reframed as if it had taken place in Tanaic and Amoraic times, in the time of the Mishnah of the Gemara. According to other views, it actually is from Talmudic times, and according to even other views, it even predates Talmudic times. So either way, the Merkava and the Hechalot literature is a very ancient literature, and it's not at all like the literature of the Zohar. If you study the Zohar, in a sense, the Zohar, I think you could call a theosophy, like a philosophy of esoteric literature. You don't find that philosophical thread running through Merkava and Hechalot literature because it's very much hands-on.
Right.
A lot of the literature reads like a recipe book almost for spells, adjurations, theurgy, which is magic as opposed to theosophy, the use of divine names, and manipulations of energies. So it's a very, very, very different kind of Kabbalah, a very practical kind of mysticism. So that is our question. Was Rashi familiar with Merkava and Heichalot literature?
And related to this is the issue of whether Rashi, in addition to his familiarity or non-familiarity with the Merkava and Heichalot literature, is, you know, what were his beliefs about the corporeality of God, right? And this is a topic of controversy, but, you know, Rashi predates the Rambam by quite a bit of time. And so he didn't have the idea of, you know, Rambam's principles of emunah, right? His like principles of Judaism that are fundamental. And so there was some, perhaps disagreement in the Jewish world about whether God is corporeal or not, which sounds incredible to the modern ears, but there are significant opinions that Rashi was a corporealist.
Yeah, there are two wonderful papers that have been written. One is, Rashi was a corporealist. And the other paper is, no, Rashi was not a corporealist. So there's a lot of debate as to whether or not Rashi believed that God had a body. We're not really talking about a body in terms of a human body. We're talking about having some kind of form.
Right.
And one of the rabbis of the time wrote Rov Chochmei Tzorfat Makshimim Haim. The majority of the rabbis of northern France believed that God had some kind of corporeality, some kind of bodily structure or form. And there's a lot of indication that Rashi may have held similar views. We know that Rashi read Sefer Koma, which is a book that describes God in a bodily form. But I think that's a topic for another subject. But the point that you raised, Jordan, about Rashi dying more or less 30 years before Rambam is born, our paradigms are no longer the same paradigms as we have today. Today, when we talk about mysticism and rationalism, we know that mysticism is basically Zoharic or Lurianic literature. And we know that rationalism is basically Maimonidean rationalism. But Rashi lived before both of those. So when we talk about rationalism and mysticism, our paradigms are very, very different. So we shouldn't project back based on what we think we know about mysticism and rationalism today onto Rashi.
Exactly.
Because the mysticism and the rationalism would have been a very, very different kind of literature.
Right, and not altogether foreign to us, but perhaps the mysticism of Rashi's day and the rationalism of Rashi's day were a subset of what we would now consider to be Jewish mysticism and Jewish rationalism.
Yeah, but I would even venture to say that some of them would be quite surprising to us in terms, especially in terms of the mysticism, in terms of the style of the mysticism. You know, when people talk about mysticism, when people market Shiurim today in Hasidus, in Kabbalah, it's presented as being very, very much a philosophy. It's almost Zen-like. You know, it's presented in a very, very mystical manner, very resonating very strongly with the modern ear, to the modern ear. But Merkava and Heichalot literature is very, very different. In a sense, a lot of it sounds like witchcraft. Konefogel even uses the word white magic. So it's a very, very different kind. That's Professor Konefogel from Yeshiva University, Ephraim Konefogel. It's a very, very different kind of mysticism. It's not a sophisticated philosophical set of concepts at all. It's hands-on, it's practical, it's spells, it's manipulations of names, and very primitive in a sense, and crude.
Yeah, right. I was going to say kind of
to the modern,
more
yeah.
ancient. Yeah, ancient. More ancient, yeah. So our main topic for today, though, is whether Rashi was a mystic or not. And we have two opinions arguing against this, and arguing for this. Arguing against it is Professor Joseph Dan, who believes that Rashi was not aware of mystical traditions based on some texts that he wrote in his commentaries. And the contrary opinion from Professor Ephraim Konefogel, who you just mentioned, who provides evidence supporting the idea that Rashi was aware of mystical traditions and perhaps was a mystic himself. So perhaps we can start by going into Joseph Dan's opinion and the evidence that he has that Rashi was not familiar with this Heichalot and Merkava literature.
Yes, so the first support that Joseph Dan brings to show that Rashi would not have been aware of mystical literature is in one of Rashi's commentary in the book of Ezekiel, Yechezkel, where the Merkava or the divine chariot is described. And Rashi says, Loi nasan rishus lisboinen b'mikra zeh. Rashi says very succinctly and very clearly, matter-of-factly, we do not have permission to contemplate on this scripture or on this verse. We don't have permission to dwell on this matter. So from this text, we could either say Rashi didn't know what the verse meant, the verse describing the Merkava, the divine chariot, or he wasn't prepared. But Rashi's answer is succinct. It's short. It's to the point. Very simple. Lo natan reshut. We do not have permission. In other words, it's a no-go area. No, no, no. We do not delve into such topics. So that's a very good support for Dan, because clearly Rashi is saying, we're not going there. Dan brings another commentary of Rashi. Rashi is saying, Asur lehitponen. This is on another pasuk. Rashi says, Asur lehitponen bepasuk. Rashi's wording is even stronger over here. Rashi says, it's absolutely forbidden to contemplate on this verse. So once again, very much like the first commentary of Rashi, this commentary, again, reiterates that this is an area where Jews do not go. We're not allowed to involve ourselves in such matters of the Merkava. These are far too lofty. These are far too mystical. They are far too deep. We just don't go there. Then Joseph Dan brings another sort. And this time he brings a support from the Gemara, from the Talmud in Chagiga. And it's the famous story of Rabbi Akiva and his three colleagues who go into the Paradis, the allegorical orchard, right, which we know wasn't really a garden, but they started delving into the secrets of mysticism. And it's fascinating because the Talmud records, it says, Amar lahem Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva said to his colleagues, he issues a warning to them, and he says, Kashatem magim, when you arrive, Etzel avne shayish tahor, next to the shiny marble, the pure marble stones, which are going to shimmer and shine, al tomru maim maim, don't shout out water, water. In other words, don't confuse the shiny marble for water, for a watery surface. Okay, that is all the Talmud tells us about Rabbi Akiva's warning.
Right.
We don't know why. What is wrong with water? Why can't you reference water? Somehow Rabbi Akiva appears to be afraid of water. And
or
he
afraid
warns
of
his
saying water.
afraid of seeing water or perceiving water. And he warns his colleagues against making that mistake. But we don't know why. We don't know why. The Heichalot literature, the early mystical literature, fills in the gap. And we have various texts, both in Heichalot Rabati and Heichalot Zutarti, which tell us that the appearance of water within a mystical vision is a sign of spiritual failure. You have failed in your vision. Your journey is over. Get out of your lofty state and go home. Based on this Heichalot literature, we can understand why Rabbi Akiva warned his colleagues about drawing attention to water, because as soon as they draw attention to water, their journey is over, they must go home. But the interesting thing is Rashi, commenting on the Talmud, Rashi appears to not know about this section of Heichalot literature, where it's explained that water is an indication that you've come to the end of the road. Rashi doesn't seem to be aware at all. In fact, Rashi says something To the contrary, Rashi says, Al tom remai mayim, Rashi says, Yesh kan ech nelech. There still is space for you. Continue on your journey. You can still carry on. Don't worry if you see So Rashi appears not to understand or not to know the concept in Hechalot literature that water is a no-no, and he appears to say, don't worry, just carry on. You know, put your mind to it. So you see water, okay, maybe you shouldn't see water because Rabbi Akiva warns against water, but nonetheless, you can continue with your journey. Mm-hmm. So based on these three commentaries of Rashi, two from the Tanakh and one from the Gemara in Chagiga, Professor Joseph Dan makes what appears to be a very, very reasonable, he comes to a very reasonable conclusion that Rashi was not aware of Hechalot literature, because either he tells you that you're not allowed to go into that literature, or he says things that appear to be in contradiction to the prevalent Hechalot literature, indicating again that Rashi wasn't aware of Hechalot. And essentially that then is the argument of Joseph Dan, that Rashi was not aware of Hechalot literature, and therefore he went into the Pshat, which we all know wasn't really Pshat, it was Midrash, but Rashi basically then, with his commentary, without input and influence from Merkava and Hechalot literature.
So now we come to the opposite opinion from Professor Dan, which is Professor Kanarfogel's, that Rashi was aware of Hechalot mysticism, and part of this argument is based on variant readings of the mystical texts themselves, right?
Right, right. So Professor Kanarfogel finds a variant reading of another Hechalot text. And according to this text, water is not a no-no. Water is a challenge, but it doesn't necessarily have to indicate the end of the journey. This is a variant text. And he's going to try and show that Rashi may have been aware of this variant text, because Rashi says, carry on anyway, and this seems to fit in with this variant Hechalot text. And this variant text basically says, water is not a good thing. Everybody agrees, Altum Rimae Maim, water is not a good thing. For some reason, I don't know what the reason is, but water is not a good thing in the mystic's journey. The impression of water, the vision of water is not a good thing. However, according to this variant Hechalot text, if you persist and you break through that perceived barrier, you can continue with your journey, and you might even be the stronger for it. And the proof that this text brings is actually the common story in the Torah about the Jews at the Red Sea. They came to what looked like water, what was water, the Red Sea, the reed. And Nachshon ben Aminadav walks into the sea, the water comes up to his neck, and the sea split. We all know this. And because of the determination of the Jews and their will to pursue and continue with their journey, the water split, and they managed to walk on dry land. So too, this variant text says, if you see water, it's not a good thing, because water is an obstacle to a journey. But if you fight it, if you show perseverance, you can break through. And this variant text that Kanarfogel found, he wants to suggest may have been a support for Rashi. And actually, if you look back at the Rashi that we just mentioned, Rashi says, Yesh kan ech nelech, there still is a way for you to go forward. It's not a good thing, water, but you can break through it. It seems to fit very, very nicely with that variant text. So it is possible. Look, there's no way we can know for sure, but it is possible that Rashi may have been familiar with that text, and his commentary on Chagiga would have been in keeping with that text. But Kanarfogel doesn't stop there, Jordan, because what he does is he shows, interestingly enough, how Rashi, in a number of other places, seems to quite openly refer to other mystical books, Hechalot and Merkava, mystical books, and they're there hidden in plain sight, which makes it quite obvious that Rashi would have been aware of mystical literature, because he quotes a number of books. So in one of Rashi's commentaries on the Gemara, in Gemara Chagiga, it's actually a page before our previous quotation from Chagiga with the story of Rabbis on the previous page. Rashi there says, Sitre Torah, he's commenting on the word Sitre Torah, the secrets of the Torah, and he says, Kagon. Rashi says, let me give you a couple of examples of mystical literature. And he mentions Maaseh HaMerkava, he mentions Sefer Yetzirah, and he mentions Maaseh Breshit, which are three works of Heichalot literature. And clearly, by referencing them, it seems to knock Professor Joseph Dan down in a way, because clearly Rashi is referencing in plain sight that he was familiar with at least three mystical works from that particular time. And Sefer Yetzirah was not a small work. So it appears as if Rashi would have been familiar with some of the foundational works of Merkava and Heichalot literature.
And then there's another example in the Tanakh commentary, right? Yes. I'm looking at, on the verse from Yeshayahu, from Isaiah, V'kara ze'el zeve amar. Right?
Yes,
and
yes.
And then he mentions this other work, Midrash Agadah Ma'aseh Merkava, right?
Right. Once again, as we say, hidden in plain sight. Rashi makes another reference to a work that has been connected to the Heichalot literature as well. In fact, Gershon Sholem says that this was a version of Heichalot Rabati, Midrash Agada Maaseh Merkava. So Rashi, according to our tally right now, is referencing four mystical works of the genre from the Heichalot and Merkava literature.
So it seems like from this evidence, so there's a good body of evidence that
yes,
even
it's
if
solid.
Yeah, despite the fact that he says, Asur lihitbonen
b'pasuk
zeh, right? It's forbidden to dwell on certain passages of, especially from Ezekiel that we just mentioned, the chariot scene in Ezekiel, in Yechezkel, that he's very familiar, or he mentions by name a number of these key works that would have been around in his era of Jewish mysticism. And so then I guess the question is, what is the origin of Rashi's mysticism? Or where did he get his mystical knowledge from, or his knowledge of these works at least?
Yeah, so that, Jordan, becomes, I think, a fascinating part of our little talk today, because if we look at where Rashi grew up, some of the figures who may have influenced Rashi, in fact, who did influence Rashi, we're going to see that Rashi was surrounded, actually, by a large number of mystics, of very influential mystics. So if we leave our texts aside, the evidence from the texts appears to be overwhelmingly in favor that Rashi was familiar with Heichalot and Merkava literature. But let's just look historically at Rashi growing up as a boy, who he would have met, where he would have gone to school, who would have taught him, and a fascinating picture begins to. So let's look at Rabbi Shimon HaGadol. Rashi studied in Worms and he studied in Mainz. Mm-hmm. When he was in Mainz, he studied according to Tosefta on Gemara Shabbos with his teacher, the Kabbalist Rabbi Shimon HaGadol. There's one problem with that Tosefta, and that we're out by about 40 years, because according to the dates that we have, Rabbi Shimon HaGadol died in 1020, and Rashi was born in 1040. So he couldn't have been his teacher unless his teacher came to him in a dream. But nonetheless, that's what the Tosefta says. So either the Tosefta is mistaken or we have the incorrect dates. I don't know. But anyway, that's one view, that Rabbi Shimon was his teacher. From Rashi's own writing, though, in one of his commentaries, Rashi tells us that Rabbi Shimon was his mother's brother. So that fits in more comfortably with the dates. His uncle could have died before Rashi was born. But either way, Rashi would have been familiar one way or another with Rabbi Shimon HaGadol, and probably very close to Rabbi Shimon HaGadol. Rabbi Shimon HaGadol was a known Kabbalist. In fact, an extreme Kabbalist. In one manuscript, Rabbi Shimon HaGadol describes how he went on a mystical journey into Shamayim, and he used certain mystical techniques. And when he was in heaven, according to the story, according to the manuscript, he found the name of God that was used when God created the world. In other words, he came into contact with the greatest energy the world has ever seen. He found this name of God that evidently no one had found before or known before him. He found it, and it was the Shem Hashem that Hashem used when he created the world. Now that's quite, Jordan, you will have to agree, that is quite an astounding claim. I mean, this rabbi was a mystical rabbi. You know, he didn't just develop a meditative technique and tell you breathe like this, breathe like that, and concentrate on this. He found something that no one else had found, and it was the greatest thing that a human being could ever find, the Shem Hashem that God used to create the world. In another section, Rabbi Shimon HaGadol describes how he learned the tunes of davening from the malachim, from the angels. So the angels taught Rabbi Shimon their tunes. Rabbi Shimon was no rationalist. Rationalists don't believe in angels. Rabbi Shimon was a mystic. The angels took him seriously. To teach someone your tunes, you've got to take them seriously. And we also know that Rabbi Shimon practiced the technique of Sheilat Chalom, dream request, which means that you go to sleep with a question on your mind, and when you wake up in the morning, you have the answer. These, again, are very, very mystical techniques. And we know that the way Rabbi Shimon went into these mystical states was through using techniques that were extremely, extremely mystical and theurgic. Another thing that Rabbi Shimon did, which is extremely controversial, and I think that must be the topic of another discussion because it's absolutely fascinating. According to Rabbi Shimon HaGadol, and later was to become a very strong Kabbalistic view as well, a very counterintuitive view that I think a lot of people will be quite surprised to see. But Rabbi Shimon HaGadol believed that when you pray, you don't so much pray to God, because you can't pray to God, because God is so above our ability to communicate with. So our prayers are addressed to energies or to entities or to angelic beings who are in charge of prayer. Sometimes they transport our prayer allegedly to God or apparently to God or apparently to higher sources. And sometimes they are even in charge of responding to our will. It's a very controversial Kabbalistic concept. I've been quite involved in research in this matter, and it's absolutely fascinating, but we don't have time to get into it now. But it's something that became part of mainstream Kabbalah in later generations, but this was a view that was espoused by Rabbi Shimon HaGadol. So I think in our description of Rabbi Shimon HaGadol, Rashi's teacher or Rashi's uncle, Rabbi Shimon HaGadol was an extreme.
And it appears that Rashi, in some of his commentary on the Gemara, echoes some of these themes of Rabbi Shimon HaGadol.
Right, where he says in almost as many words that sometimes our prayers are entrusted to the angels who are tasked with transport, dealing with them in one way.
And so that this, you know, shows that whatever the precise nature of the relationship, the actual relationship between Rabbi Shimon HaGadol and Rashi, whether he was actually his teacher or whether he was his uncle or whether he was just the representative of a tradition that was very present in Rashi's youth, that Rashi absorbed this idea and some of these mystical ideas, you know, either directly or indirectly from Rabbi Shimon HaGadol, which is really interesting.
Very, very, very interesting.
And then Rabbi Shimon HaGadol had a student, Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol.
Yeah.
Pardon me, who is much more of a candidate for having overlapped with Rashi because, you know, lived all the way through Rashi's childhood and early adulthood.
Right. He dies in 1060. Rashi was born in 1040, so they would have overlapped about 40 years. He's regarded as possibly a chavrusa Tirashi, a colleague, perhaps a student colleague. And according to Professor Konofogel, he was involved also in what Konofogel refers to as white magic techniques. Interesting to see Konofogel's not mincing his words. He chooses his words very, very carefully. He's not going to use magic techniques because he's trying to be funny. He understands the genre of this type of mysticism, which involved spells, which involved recipes and incantations, the use of the divine name. And Eliezer HaGadol, Rashi's friend or colleague, was known to have been involved in these texts as well. And what Eliezer HaGadol is famous for is instituting the custom of spilling wine at the Pesach Seder that most Jews are familiar with today. So
right.
I just want to say that from this we see a fascinating difference between a shallow vort and a deep scholarly inquiry. Because most people will tell you that the reason why we spill 10 drops of wine at the Pesach Seder, or drops of wine, because actually the original custom was 16 drops of wine, was because wine is a symbol of a Jew's joy, and because the Egyptians were drowned at the Red Sea, we feel sorry for the Egyptians, so our joy is not complete. Mm-hmm. And that's why we spill wine. I mean, I used to say this for years and years and years to guests at my Seder, that this was the reason why we spill wine at the Pesach Seder. But on further inquiry, it appears to be not the case at all. The original custom was 16 drops of wine, having nothing to do with feeling sorry for the poor Egyptians who drowned in the Red Sea. Not at all. In fact, the reason for the custom is a very, very deep and extreme mystical reason. Why 16 drops? It's a 10 plagues. And then if you look in the Haggadah, according to certain customs, my custom is then to spill twice, three other occasions. So we actually spill 16 drops, but I come from a Hasidic background. I think the rest of the Jewish world does 10. But why 16? Because according to Heichalot and Merkava literature, God has a 16-sided sword. And God uses the sword to exact vengeance against people who go against his will, according to the literature. Why 16? Because in the book of Yirmiyahu, of Jeremiah, dever, or pestilence, is mentioned 16 times. So, of course, the early mystics said that if you want to be saved from pestilence and protected against pestilence, which is mentioned 16 times, you need a 16-edged sword. And hence God has the sword. And that's why we spill 16 drops of wine, which signifies 16 drops of blood, which will come from the sword of God when God takes out his sword and smites it 16 times. In fact, the sword is called Yuhach. And Yuhach means Yud and Vav, which is 16. And Hach means to hit. So it's a sword that smites 16 times. And in fact, there's even an angel of vengeance that's called Yuach, whose job is to exact vengeance on whoever God deems necessary. So it's a very, very, very mystical concept, this notion of 16 drops, not really of wine, but really of blood, to protect you as a segula against pestilence. Nothing to do with food for the Egyptians. And this was Rashi's Chavrusa.
Right.
So Rashi's Chavrusa certainly would have been familiar with a very, very extreme theurgic type of mysticism. And another thing that Rabbi Shimon did was he spoke a lot about the Kaddish. A lot of people don't know, although Kaddish is referenced earlier in Tricha, it was round about the 12th, 13th century that Kaddish actually became a prayer that was recited after somebody died. Became part of the liturgy, but we can speak about that at a later occasion. But it's interesting that that Kaddish came about round about the same time, because Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Eliezer, the teacher and the student, spoke about Kaddish in mystical terms, completing. You know, we talk about L'shem Yichud Kutshabri, although that would have been a later mystical concept, but the idea that God's name is incomplete and we need to do certain things to complete God's name. If you don't complete God's name, which the Kaddish does, the Kaddish completes God's name, so you get the benefit of the extra energy of working with God's completed name rather than with God's broken name. And that essentially is why, according to them, you recite the Kaddish. And God's name was broken by the forces of Amalek. So once again, these are very, very mystical concepts that were spoken about, new customs that were instituted by people who were part and parcel of Rashi's circle. And then Rashi had another teacher. His real teacher, his main teacher, Yaakov ben Yakar, and we know that Yaakov ben Yakar writes a commentary on Sefer Yetzirah, which obviously is a very mystical work, and his commentary is a mystical. So I think it's an open and shut case. Rashi was familiar with Heichalot and Merkava literature, and he seems to have been surrounded by people within his milieu who were not just mystics, but extreme mystics who were very, very au fait with Merkava and Heichalot literature. And not only were they au fait with it, but it even seems as if they contributed to the literature itself.
And in addition to these colleagues and teachers and chavrusos of Rashi, who are steeped in mysticism, we have, we should probably close out with this, Rashi's own mystical references, that he, things that he says in his own commentaries that are clearly steeped in mysticism.
Yeah, so once again, this goes back to our point when we started speaking about Rabbi Karnefogel, that a lot of the clues are hidden in plain sight. We know that Rashi, in some of his commentaries, spoke a lot about the names of God, the 72 letters of the names of God. He spoke about the energy of names, the energy within letters. He also spoke in some of his Talmudic commentaries about the Amoraim, who were able to create calves and other beings by using permutations of God's names. He also spoke about, Rashi spoke about the Paradise. How did the rabbis, Rabbi Akiva and his three colleagues, go into the Paradise? They used divine names. These are all Heichalot and Merkava concepts. Rashi spoke about Kvitzat HaDerech that Rava discusses in the Gemara. How did Rava accomplish, or how was Kvitzat HaDerech accomplished? It was accomplished as a result of playing around and using and manipulating letters within the divine name of God, the divine names of God. And I think a further proof is that in the subsequent Kabbalistic literature that was to follow in the centuries after Rashi, including the Zohar, the Sefer HaMaskil, and the Ma'arechet HaLokut, those works quoted Rashi and put this whole picture together. The fact that they quoted Rashi probably means that Rashi was regarded as a mystic and an expert in Heichalot and Merkava literature, and from the sources, from Rashi's childhood experiences, from growing up in that society, and from Rashi's own writings, and even in the Sifrut Devei Rashi, in Rashi's students' writings, Machzovitri, Shabbat is referred to as a marriage between Knesset, Israel, and God. Again, a very, very mystical concept. Machzovitri was written by a student of Rashi. Put this all together, and the evidence seems to be overwhelmingly in favor of Professor Karnefogel over Joseph Dann in this particular instance. Rashi does seem to have been certainly aware of Merkava and Heichalot literature, certainly au fait with Heichalot and Merkava literature, and probably also a contributor to this literature, which is very, very important in the link of Jewish mysticism to the next generations, to what in 200 years' time was going to become the Zohar. It appears as if Rashi was not only aware of the literature, but he was an important link in the chain that was to lead later on to Zoharic Kabbalah and to Lurianic Kabbalah as well.
And so when he says things like, Asur lihitbonein al zeh, it's maybe just to dissuade the uninitiated from delving too deeply into these things.
It could very well be, but it's very, very hard to answer because we do know that there also were variant Rashi texts. And Joseph Dan certainly has points. I do not know how to reconcile some of the texts that Carnefogel brings as proofs with the Rashi texts that Dan brings as proofs. I can't wrap my head around them, because if you look at them in isolation, they both appear to be saying different things. So I don't fully understand that, but there appear to be more references in Rashi on Carnefogel's side.
Yes. Yeah, it seems that way to me as well. This is a really interesting discussion for me, because I think, like most people who aren't steeped very, very deeply in a comprehensive review of Rashi's commentary, I don't immediately associate Rashi with mystical ideas, right? It's, to me, mysticism is the Zohar. It's, the Kabbalah, the Lurianic, what we later call Lurianic Kabbalah, and it's a different sort of set of concepts. And if you had asked me before, is Rashi a talk about mystical ideas in his commentary, my thought would have been, well, I don't think so. Because if you just read Chumash with Rashi, there's not a lot of mysticism in it, right?
Yes, especially since we teach children, one of the first things that kids learn in a Torah school is they learn Rashi's commentary. So one wouldn't think that these are deep mystical teachings. Evidently, I think that the general commentary of Rashi normally is what is supposed to be pshat, but what we know is really medrash. Medrash actually is mystical, but it's allegorical mysticism. You can take it on a simple level where it's a medrashic story. But nonetheless, in some of those other texts, Rashi does appear to be very, very steeped mysticism, although the mysticism doesn't come across, as you mentioned, readily in Rashi's text. A cursory glance through Rashi, or even a deep study of Rashi, would not reveal immediately our discovery that Rashi appears to have been very, very much involved in Hechalotim literature.
Like you say, it's hiding in plain sight. This has been a really great conversation, Gavin. I this is a interesting topic for me, something I really didn't know much about. So thank you very much.
Thank you, George. It's been fascinating for me as well. And once again, lovely chatting with you. And please take care.
And you.